Here's another free chapter from my first book, How to Become a Pro Cyclist. I'm not sure you should do this. For me, it kind of worked, but it was also a bit too much at the time. Hopefully, it just gives you some ideas to do it better. If you love this content, the book is full of it, and you can only get it at howtobecomeaprocyclist.com. Oh, and there's a little gift for you at the very end of this podcast you can't get anywhere else, so you might want to listen right to the end. Hope you enjoy. Chapter 24, Motor Pacing. Almost all the gains you can get from motor pacing you can now get with a smart trainer, except maybe full-blast sprint training. Motor pacing's a lot more fun, though. I haven't done any motor pacing since I came to Europe 4 years ago, but that's because I haven't had anyone to take me, not because I don't think it's useful. I wish I still had that option because it's a game changer for adding that last little bit before racing. The year before, Creed and I were in the car returning from a race. We were joking about one of the riders complaining about us not having skin suits with zippers down the back because it was faster, but yet that same rider was always complaining the training was too hard or too long and DNF'd races he could have finished. Marginal gains are great, but you also have to have the basic abilities of an athlete figured out first, and that's what Creed was always hammering on about. Creed compared concentrating on marginal gains like everyone having a hammer, and going into the races like you're all lined up with your hammers and you're going to go see who can knock each other's house down first. Creed said all these marginal gains, like a different skin suit, are like putting a special rubber grip on your hammer. Yeah, it's going to let you swing it a little bit better, it will help, but if you have a 16-ounce roofing hammer, you've polished up and put the most ergonomic grip on, and you show up to the Rumble, and the guy beside you rocks up with an old 20-pound sledgehammer with an old wood handle on it, you think he cares what kind of grip or glove you have on? You, him, and everyone else know he's going to knock the shit out of you, and he doesn't care what grip he has on his hammer. Yes, the marginal gains are essential, but the size of your hammer is the fitness and the basics. If you make it to the World Tour, they have every grip and glove you could imagine to trick out whatever hammer you bring them, but they can't make the hammer that much bigger. That's your job. You make the biggest hammer, and then the team works on the smaller gains to improve it. You do your job, they will do theirs. The story Creed gave me next is what really got me fired up. Mike, if you're reading this, I hope you don't mind me telling it. Mike Creed was one of the best American cyclists in the generation directly following Lance, and after coming up in the US, he earned a spot on the Discovery team. In his first year, he struggled like all neopros, and towards the end of the year, a doctor told him he was too fat and how great he could be if he lost a couple kilos. Next year was a contract year, and everyone always says getting your first World Tour contract is the second hardest, and the hardest one is your second contract. In the first contract, the team sees some potential and is taking a risk with the idea that with all they can offer you, they can improve you by X percent. They're giving you the benefit of the doubt that you can become great, but then, to get the second contract, you have to live up to what they imagined you could become. Going into a contract year and motivated to show he belonged on the best team in the world, Creed took the extreme approach and lost way too much weight over the winter, which, as it usually does, worked for a few weeks, which happened to line up with the first team camp in early spring, where he wiped the floor with everybody, Lance, Levi, George, all of them. My words, not his. Because he was so strong at team camp, the team picked him to be the leader at the first race of the season. 2 weeks later, his body finally said enough, and while he was at an airport on the way to the race, his molar fell out of his mouth. He starved himself so much and pushed his body so far that now he was so weak and falling apart that his tooth fell out of his head. He was terrible at the race because he was so weak, which ruined his last season on Discovery. Towards the end of the summer, he would get one more chance to try and get a result at a one-day race in San Francisco to get him another contract and save his career. Discovery had already told him he wasn't getting re-signed, but he could still try to get a spot on another team. Now healthy and eating normal again, he was afraid to overdo things again, so his idea was to all about quality and not quantity. For the last 2 weeks before the race, Creed motor paced 3 days on, 1 day off, every day for 4 hours at the highest pace he could barely hold for 4 hours. No warm up, just out the door, roll for 5 minutes, then the scooter would hit it, and he'd hold the wheel at that really uncomfortable pace where you can't talk and can barely hold this for 4 hours, then be completely roasted. If you try to do this without the scooter, you won't get the same effect because the feeling in the muscles from being at that speed is different, and there's not the same kind of constant muscle tension and micro accelerations that roast your legs the way you do in a race. The way the muscles fire at 50 kilometers an hour is different from 30 kilometers an hour, which is often why you can't put out the same power on the flats that you can on a climb. I don't know if the race was the best performance of his life, but he was on a different level and murdered the field. Riding around off the front with enough of a lead to get off his bike at the top of the climb each lap and lift his bike over his head and yell at the crowd. That's one way to go with a bang. Sitting in the car next to him and hearing this story, what I heard in my mind was, don't show up to the race with a sledgehammer. You need to train so hard that when everyone's opening their toolboxes and hammers to get ready for the Rumble, you're going to open yours and there isn't going to be a hammer. There's going to be a set of keys to the bulldozer. In 2018, I did the biggest block of training up until that point in my career. I took a week off and then won the Mount Megantic stage of the Tour de Beauce while breaking the record up the final mountain and taking the yellow leader's jersey. Well, that went well, so I guess I should just double it again for Utah and Colorado in a few weeks and I'll be even better. The stats for the Mount Megantic stage were In the morning, I was 67 kilos, so after breakfast and fueled up, shoes and kit on, maybe 68 kilos. The total stage was 4 hours and 17 minutes with a normalized power of 313 watts. The final 17 minutes and 40 seconds, I normalized 449 watts. So at 68 kilos, that's 6.6 watts per kilo. Side note on weight. To get ready for Utah and Colorado, I did the most brutal block of my life again, where for 3 weeks I did 3 days on, 1 day off. To be clear, I wouldn't do nearly as much low-carb stuff nowadays, but in 2018, that was still a thing, and it did work to get me crazy skinny. Another key point is I could get away with this in North America where the racing is less explosive, so if I was starving and exhausted, I could always diesel my way through it. Since coming to Europe, I've needed more explosive power to handle all the fighting for position before the climbs, so while my weight fluctuated a lot in my first years here when I was still trying to figure out how to manage weight loss with all the racing, for the last 2 years my weight's been more like a steady 71 kilos, which is closer to my natural weight. My weight went up, but so did the power, so my watts per kilo stayed the same, and even more importantly, my performance was a lot more consistent. This is the sweet spot you should look for when your watts per kilo doesn't drop as your weight goes up, because if you can do 6.5 watts per kilo at 70 kilos, you'll be even with a 60 kilo rider that can also only do 6.5 watts per kilo on a climb. But you have the advantage when the road is flat as long as your relative aerodynamics are also even. It's also more useful to pro teams to have a bigger rider who can get over the mountains than a little guy who can't pull so much on the flats and only offers a little bit of draft to his teammates. The off rest days were 1.5 hours with no breakfast and low carb for the rest of the day. The on days were like this. The minimum standard I had to have for each of the 3 on days between rest days was 7 hours and 5,000 meters of climbing each day. I'd eat a salad bowl full of oats for breakfast, go training all day, and wouldn't let myself eat for the last 2 hours of the endurance riding home to Squamish after the efforts on Mount Cypress were done. I'd come home and sit in the sauna at the Squamish golf course, then walk outside with my headlamp and sit in the Squamish River for cold therapy. Cold therapy is good for many things, but not cycling. So that was a dumb mistake. It did help me get better sleep, and maybe it helped me get a bit skinnier, but the added stress was too much, and it hurt me in the heat at Utah. The sauna was good, the icy river not so much. I'd have a giant salad, those 7 superfood salad kits for the North Americans, with an avocado and chicken breast for dinner, then go to sleep, so excited thinking about how good breakfast was going to be the next morning because I was already so hungry. I was making the mistake of having too many carbs in the morning and not enough before bed. It would have been better to divide them more evenly to improve my sleep and recovery. I kept this up for 23 days, but the Jelly Belly team owner, Danny Van Hout, was forcing everyone that was going to do Utah and Colorado to do an altitude training camp in Breckenridge, Colorado, which is at 3,000 meters elevation for 8 days, finishing 2 days before the race. None of the riders wanted to go because the idea of coming from sea level and going to 3,000 meters for 8 days right before the race sounded like just enough to kill us. Danny's heart's always been in the right place. He went to the Olympics himself, and he's been around so long that he's the one that took Mike Creed to Europe for the first time when Creed was a junior. He's given a lot of guys opportunities over the years, but still, sports science isn't what he majored in, and negotiating a compromise wasn't how he ruled the Jelly Belly Candy Kingdom. I was afraid of losing all this hard work at training camp after how easy our spring training camp was, so I figured I had to totally kill myself in training before the team camp. That way, I could relax at team camp and be ready to race. Looking back, it actually might have worked if I had had the confidence to rest at team camp, but when you're young and dumb, you think all that work's going to disappear when you rest. So I kept training 5 to 7 hours a day when I got to Breckenridge. Here's the training during the 3 week block before the team camp in Breckenridge. I was between 67 and 69 kilos. Every on day had to be at least 7 hours and 5,000 meters of climbing. Some days I was totally wrecked and it took 9 hours to get the 5,000 meters of climbing in. Warm up, leave my house in Squamish, and ride easy for the first 17 minutes to warm up. Once I got to the Mags 99, now Sunny Chiba's and the best Mexican food in town, I'd hit the lap button as I left town. I'd then hold between 280 and 310 watts normalized for 1 hour and 50 minutes while I rode down the Sea to Sky Highway from Squamish to Vancouver. I'd hit the lap button again at the highway sign for Mount Cypress and roll easy for 2 minutes into the gas station. Fill my backpack with food and water for the session. If I normalized over 290 watts for the almost 2-hour ride to the mountain, I was on a good day. If it was 260 to 280, this would be a double or triple energy drink kind of day. I had a 3-liter Camelback with me, plus another 2 liters in bottles on my bike. I'd slug the 5 liters of water and food for 20 minutes to the bottom of the climb where I'd hide my stash behind the concrete barrier, then start the efforts at Mount Cypress. I'd tempo up to the first hairpin, about 12 minutes, then start the 8x4 minute VO2s at 465 to 475 watts with 4-minute recoveries. Next, I'd roll down to the bottom of the mountain, refill my bottles, and restart with 4x10 minute 40-20s all out, typically ending with a normalized power of about 420 to 430 watts for each 10-minute effort. Next was 2 10-minute blocks of 20-40s to really empty the tank. I don't remember watching the watts in this effort, I just remember being cross-eyed for the 20 seconds on, then barely able to turn the cranks for 40 seconds recovery, still crawling up the mountain. I'd then reload everything and carry any remaining food and water to add extra weight to make the climb longer, for a bottom-to-top tempo effort of around 35 minutes at 365 to 380 watts. I made sure to have a good amount of candy and chocolate bars before this last effort because that was the last food I'd let myself eat for the next 3 hours till I got home. After that last tempo effort, I'd ride down the mountain, then ride endurance 2 hours easy home. Easy meant 200 to 210 watts, but there were a few days where I felt great and pushed a little more. This was day one of the three-day block, and I always got it done. Typically on day two, I might skip the four-minute VO2s because I was too tired to hit the numbers, and instead I'd replace it with an extra tempo effort up Cypress at the end. Third day of the block was always a gong show, and on the worst days where I was totally broken, I'd just ride to the climb and climb the mountain 7 times as hard as I could to bring the ride time to more like 8 or 9 hours and finish in the dark. Then I'd roll down to the highway and hitchhike home. Everyone has trucks in BC, so hitchhiking with a bike is easy. During this 3-week block, there was the White Rock Road Race and the Delta Road Race on the second and third weekends of that 3-week block. Both are UCI 1.2 one-day races. I raced them both, but treated them just like day ones in the block, so I'd have one easy day the day before each. I managed to get through this block of training for 3 weeks, but then with Creed's sledgehammer, my bulldozer analogy, pumping me up, I wanted to try and really make sure the tank was entirely empty before flying to Breckenridge for team camp, so I found a way to push it even harder. I took an easy day, then finished things with one last 3-day block, all motor pacing, up and down Squamish Valley Road. First day, 280 kilometers in 5 hours and 35 minutes. Second day, 316 kilometers in 6 hours and 13 minutes. Third day, 316 kilometers in 6 hours and 17 minutes. The next day, I got on the plane to Breckenridge. Craziest part about these motor pacing sessions was that in Squamish, there's only Squamish Valley Road to do them on, so we just went out and back, up and down the same 18-kilometer stretch of road, meaning we did 8 out and back laps of the valley on those 316-kilometer days with never more than a few minutes rest every few hours to change bottles or gas up a scooter from the jerry can we hid in the bushes. Squamish is an amazing place to live if you love mountain sports, but it's terrible for road cycling. Back then, I thought it was amazing for road cycling because I'd never been anywhere else and I didn't know any better. When I go back now, I think, damn, I used to be so much tougher before I knew what the good life was like. Now that I know what it's like to ride in the Alps, riding that fucking sea to sky highway is so much harder. For anyone that's been to Squamish and knows Squamish Valley Road, we hid the spare gas can in my Dakine backpack full of water bottles in the bushes at the last speed bump when you're leaving the last houses and heading out the valley. I clicked the lap button once we got over the final speed bump and we pinned it out to where the pavement stops at the end of the valley. And back, over and over and over again until I couldn't do it anymore. I had a list of 16 friends from around town. None were road cyclists, and I'd call them up to ask them to take me motor pacing. They'd swap out and rotate through as they got tired, so I always had someone to take me. Thank goodness I was on Jelly Belly then, because I didn't have any money, but I could pay them in Jelly Belly candy. I think the going rate was 20 beans per kilometer. Brett Ward ended up with a hockey bag full of beans. The scooter was an old 50cc two-stroke that topped out at 70 kilometers an hour on a flat road with a tailwind, so we had it on the red line for hours nonstop. I had to rebuild the engine twice because we torched the little piston. Another buddy, Dave Heisler, had to weld a new wheel for it because we broke that too. And when the speedometer broke, we gorilla taped my Suunto watch over it. On Jelly Belly, we were sponsored by Suunto, and they gave us their nicest smartwatch, but I hated it. The watch was great, and I'm sure you'd love it, if you like that stuff. But it could do everything you imagine, but I hated having another thing buzzing at me, telling me all these things my phone already did. So I never used it and went back to my old black ProTrek dumb watch that I hadn't taken off since my 22nd birthday. ProTreks are like G-Shocks, but with some different features for mountaineering for you gear nerds. The speedometer on the scooter broke, we taped the Suunto over it, and suddenly my scooter had GPS, Bluetooth, weather alerts, heart rate, a compass, notifications, and probably some other stuff. It was great because now the guys could see my heart rate to really push me, but because we had a fixed course, Squamish Valley Road, they started to race each other, thinking it was funny to see how fast they could get me to go. A bunch of them all worked and still work at Corsa Cycles in Squamish, now Corsa Dunbar, and so they'd take me for a rip, then at work they'd start comparing how fast they got me going. Brett Ward, Mike Carney, Dwayne Kress, Alex Hinkson, Nick Morgan, and Liam Burke, I can't thank you all enough for the times you took me to rip my legs off. One time, Brett and I finished a session in the early spring when it was snowing, but not sticking to the ground. I was so cold, but at least I was moving to stay warmer. Brett was in a snowmobile suit, but it soaked right through, and when I punched the lap button on that last rep, I rode up beside him to give him a fist bump. He was jackhammering, he was shivering so bad. He was wearing a snowsuit and his snowmobile helmet, and I could still see him shaking like crazy under all of that. He was freezing, but he never said a word to complain the whole time. I felt so bad for putting him through that, but it motivates you to see your friends who don't know a thing about road cycling suffering so much to try to help you. Man, I better make it. I owe it to those guys. Hey, if you thought that was good content, it would mean a lot to me if you shared it. It really does make a huge difference, and hopefully it only takes you a second, but it helps me more than you know. And if you do share it and you tag me in it, you can send me a message and ask me to send you another chapter of the book of your choosing for free. You don't have to pay me anything for it if you're still considering getting the book. That's my little way of saying thank you, but I promise you'd still be doing more for me than I'd be doing for you, so I'd still owe you one down the road. All right, thanks, bud.